Welcome to the Lights Out Podcast. This is Chris Lights Out Lytle, and this is our journey to document the history of mixed martial arts. I have brought with me my friend, the MMA detective Mike Davis, and together we will preserve the history and hear some great stories from the world in the era of the no holds barred. Thank you and enjoy.
Welcome back to the Lights Out MMA History Podcast. I am Joey Venti. I'm with the host of the show, the MMA detective Mike Davis. We have a special Battlecade Roundtable edition today. Once again, we're joined by a friend of the show and founding fossil of mixed martial arts, John Peretti. John was able to land us a guest who's been on our wish list for years. He's a Jean LaBelle black belt, a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, fighter, trainer, gym owner, promoter, filmmaker, and the first person to erase the Gracie aura of invincibility live on pay-per-view. He's had a profound impact on the sport we all love. Welcome to the show, John Lewis. John and John, thank you.
Thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it. Thanks, John, for having me.
That is very true, man. First off, let's just clear the table. John Lewis, why do you not like giving interviews?
Because I don't care about it. None of this stuff matters, to be honest with you, at the end of the day. And especially those old things. No one cares about that as far as I'm concerned. Like, the nowadays, there's a whole new generation of kids, a new generation of people. And that era is, like, to me, like the eras of boxing that only the real people that box really appreciate, the guys who fought for 45 minutes. I mean, for, you know, 4 hours straight. So it's like I'm just rehashing old stuff. And I definitely don't like to get into it where I'm, you know, dissing on this person and trying to defend why I did bad at that time. Or it's just not my thing. I'm a move forward kind of guy, you know. But to get a chance to be with John on something, which after all this time, was an honor. And I know you guys have been talking to me a few times about getting on. So I wanted to do this for you guys. And here we are.
Yeah, that's good. Well, here, let's talk about what you're doing now. Let's get the plugs out of the way.
Well, I do a lot of different things. Obviously, I'm film producing movies and acting for a long time now. But also, I have a company that I'm the CEO of called NovaCorp Aerospace, which is an aerospace company that is really focused on doing entertainment in both Earth and space as well, working with SpaceX and other people. And I'm not going to get too much into it because it's a long conversation. It's probably longer than this whole interview would be, but it's a pretty innovative new thing that I'm doing. And it's working with a lot of the different government agencies and such to do some pretty new things now with space tourism.
As crazy as space tourism sounds, and it's like, I can't wrap my head around it. It's a very, very hot topic right now. Like, once again, you seem to be on the cutting edge of what's taking place.
Google, later on, you have a chance, just Google the Hilton and space station. You'll see the Hilton has already signed a deal with a company called Voyager Space that I also work with to build a hotel. They already signed a contract 2 years ago and for 2030-ish, 2029. This is all very, very real. It's not, and just, I would say the scenario that I'm running right now is the scenario that the UFC Denver was in, or a little after that. You know what I mean? It's like, it's that beginning, you know? So the people involved right now are going to be those people then, you know?
That's wild. John Peretti, why don't you explain to us how this gentleman got on your radar? Because you were the guy that brought John Lewis to the forefront of the early days of mixed martial arts.
And John, correct me if I'm wrong, please. I came to California from New York. My school was in New York City at 109 West 26th Street. It was a famous school because everybody came from all over the world to be there. But I came to California basically to put my hands and feet in my pockets and become a LaBellian in every sense of the word. We were introduced by Peter McGuire, who has selective amnesia at this point in his life. And I thought we hit it off really well. We trained together. I would say from the get-go, you know, he had I was really enamored with him. He was acrobatic. He was incredibly athletic. He was he heard the music. You know, I don't hear the music. but he heard the music. I was just really impressed. And what's the matter, Mike?
No. I agree. I would say
to the bathroom.
It's probably later. Yes. John Lewis, like with hearing all of this, like for instance, when you came to the forefront, you had the look, you had like the energy about you. It's kind of like you understood what a package fighter was supposed to look, feel, and handle themselves like way before like anybody else. How does it get to that point?
To be honest with you,
you're asking. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
No, I stepped. I don't know. I don't know what happened, but I stepped on you, John. I'm sorry.
You're fine, man. Was that question to me?
Yes, it was, John Lewis.
It's not like I planned it or anything like that. It was just me being who I naturally was, and some of those things obviously transcended into what you're saying. But it's just the kind of person that I was. You know, I wasn't a package that was put together. You know. Be clear, I wouldn't even be fighting in MMA if John didn't bring me into it. When we get to it later on, you'll get to the point of the probably the fight that happened in Hawaii, which even that was John. So, and he's like, get out of your backyard. You know, so I won't get ahead of ourselves, but what John's saying is exactly correct. And up until that time, I was teaching people in my house, out of my backyard. I had this whole compound set up. He can tell you about. It's pretty funny. Like one of those movies that the poles on the ground and then rocks for your, I mean, I was all into everything. Right. And I had a poster out that said anyone 6'6" or taller or 250 or heavier that would train for free. Cause I wanted to continue to fight as many people as I could that were out of my element so that I could create what I thought was my own style, which today is called JSEC. And Peter McGuire did bring John over. And that was the first time that I was able to work with someone that was a real professional fighter. And he was freaking amazing. I mean, the stuff he was doing, kicking me in the back of the head with hook kicks from in front of me. So it was definitely a big, for me, he was a mentor to me. John was a mentor to me. And he had been ever since then in my fighting career.
So John Peretti, his backyard dojo. What do you remember?
Oh my God. As a prerequisite to this conversation, I lived in Chinatown in New York City, right? So I was a guy who had a basement in my parents' house, you know, who had, you know, all my heroes on the walls and all this Bruce Lee-isms and stuff. So when you went into his, I want to say one car garage, but I guess it's a two car garage, John.
Yeah.
So it was maybe a 1.5 car garage. In fact, I think I had sex with this beautiful actress in that garage. But anyway, that's true, right, John?
No comment.
I'm blonde.
It is true.
That garage was like this incredible red and black homage to Bruce Lee. I mean, it had tassels and dragons and shit and hanging from the fucking ceilings and oh my God. And then finally mats on the ground and oh man, we trained so hard there. It was incredible. And it was great. It was just great. So it was a real throwback in that. And John was like, you know, totally involved in all that stuff. So he started doing Wing Chun with me, which I had 10 years in by then, you know, and we had so much fun doing hands. And then we did knife on knife. And then, you know, which I had 8 years in with my dear friend and yellow belt, Edward Mufel, who was the fencing champion of Russia. And God, we just had a blast. And the motherfucker was so hungry, which I had a hard time finding people in my life that were hungry, because I was always hungry, right? But he was a voracious motherfucker, and he could absorb information instantaneously. And I have a fucking incredible eye for talent. I can smell talent. But he's one of those guys who had I was 139 pounds, by the way. That's what I fought at, you know, throwing legs around. I mean, and really, all I had was quick little hands. I couldn't break an egg. and a right leg, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it could be from sides when from in front of me. Yeah.
So the thing was that he was just, well, he was mesmerizing in that, and he learned so quickly. But yeah, the place was hilarious. And actually, I hid in his backyard for 4 days after the earthquake, which John and I almost died. If it was a 24-hour difference, we almost died coming back from LaBelle's red dungeon. And we came across a bridge at 4:15 in the morning. And the next day at 4:15 in the morning, a motorcycle went across that bridge and the bridge fell down and flew. That motorcycle flew. It's probably the first time since Knievel that a motorcycle flew.
Yeah.
And we would have died on that fucking bridge because we crossed that bridge at exactly the same time. I shit you not.
Wow. So you guys are both Judo Jean LaBelle black belts?
Who? Well, no, he is before me. In fact, I wouldn't even be a black belt from Jean LaBelle if it wasn't for John Lewis.
No way. Because I thought it was the opposite.
No, sir. It's Silverado. I don't remember his first name, but it's in my book. I list the black belts there, and that's his actual name. And then there was John Donahue, my just heroic referee, and that who was another sycophant of jiu-jitsu. Oh, did I say that out loud?
Yeah, you did.
And then it was John Lewis, and then it was John Peretti.
So, John Lewis, how do you make the connection with Jean LaBelle?
Man, I don't remember where I first met him from. I'd almost want to think that I was thinking maybe John introduced me. I don't remember.
Yes,
you, right? You introduced me.
I brought you up to the cabin.
Yeah, and that's how I met him. And then we started going there all the time, you know. And I know that I think if I'm correct, you tell me if I'm wrong, John, because you have a better memory than me. But those first three black belts. We all got at the same time. So it was like, I think we're all, so there's really, there's been
times. Not me though.
No. Yeah. So there'd be times you hear me say, I'm the first American black belt from Jean LaBelle, but really it's just who, as we sat next to each other, was given it. You know what I mean? So I think really he is correct. There's a little piece of paper that comes out that says numbers. And I think mine says three. But really, if I stood on this side of the line, I would have been one. Yeah. So it's all that same time. Yeah. And then then John was right after us. But
so 30 yeah. seconds. There's about 30 second difference between
you. Doesn't mean anybody. I'm not taking anything from anybody.
I don't want to take any. I don't want to take anything away from somebody. And I think Silverado predated us.
He was there
with Gene.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's there first. All right.
That's
so
correct.
They had time there. Yeah. But we all got it that same day, but they had time before us there. Yeah.
That highest stand system.
What?
The highest stand system, Judo Jean LaBelle.
Oh, those are
whoa, different. Whoa.
Those are different.
Whoa. Time out. That's not the highest stand system.
Well, let me finish my statement, John Peretti. The highest stand system's roots are Judo Jean LaBelle. Carol Parisian, Manny Gambarian, they're highest stand, and they're go ahead and say something about Judo Jean. Those guys will tear your head off. Like they hold that guy in the highest of regards.
Yeah, but I think high stand is go-kart school. And Jean,
thank you.
Go-kart was the issue. That's the issue. Jean LaBelle that was where he would consider his home away from home.
But Mondays.
Highest stand is go-kart school. Yeah.
Okay.
Obviously, Gokar and Gene are family, obviously. Yeah.
So, in regards to like the uninformed, which two of us in this conversation were at this point, everyone thought it was jiu-jitsu. And then we thought, oh, it's Judo Jean LaBelle. Dude, it's judo. It's an Olympic sport. What you see Brian Battle in the UFC right now, I mean, the roots of it they're still in the UFC, and it's truly incredible, like where you guys came from and like the statements that you guys made in combat sports. What about your transition to jiu-jitsu with Andre Pettinaris, John Lewis?
Well, first of all, I didn't really, I wouldn't say I transitioned. I always taught training as many possible things as I possibly could at the same time that I could manage. I was already skilled in judo and grappling with Gene and had very good understanding of submission already. So it wasn't like I walked in as with zero knowing, you know, an understanding or something like that. I had a very good background in martial arts already. But I did want to really excel. And I was with Hickson first, and then we'll get to that probably, but I said Hickson first, and I ended up going to Machado's for a very short time. But it was always the, you know, the same thing where you kind of just wasn't quite accepted in. And almost the better you were and the more ambitious you were as an American, more they were careful with you. Obvious reasons. If I was just some guy that just, you know, worked at some facilities, that's one thing, but they see me as someone who wants to fight, and that makes them glad, you know, maybe for good reason from their perspective. And then a guy named Marco Jara, who passed away a long time ago, he was shot, is the one who connected me and Andre, saying I had this guy named Andre Pedaneris. He's a great team in Brazil. By the way, there was no nobody else. It was just Andre Pedaneris. It was the devil Andre Pedaneris Jiu-Jitsu. And that was when he tied up, when he connected with Wendell Alexander, is when they created Nova Niao in 95. And I was the president of the United States. So that was the guy he said, and by the way, Andre spoke no English. So he came to America for me and him to work together because I needed someone really great in jiu-jitsu to grow my skill sets. And he wanted to transition into America. So we had this great match. I went to Brazil, trained for a long time, and against all the best guys. That's when Shaolin and Hobson Moore and all the guys were there, you know, in the school, trained with all the great guys. And it was back and forth. He'd come to me, I'd come to him. We did videos together. We did a lot of stuff together. But that transition for me was just the first Brazilian who was really open to teaching an American wholeheartedly, just big heart, like kind, wasn't trying to protect anything, would teach me as fast as I could learn, John was saying, and I could learn fast. And the faster he would show me, I just learn it. And it's just like this. And I just grew so quickly during that time. But it was really not like me not believing in one. I couldn't have been as good in jiu-jitsu at that time if I hadn't had Gene LaBelle that got me to having that skill set. I always said the magic of Brazilian jiu-jitsu is the movement between the submissions, not the submissions. Submissions existed forever, right? So if you already come with the understanding of submissions, and then you just add that movement of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, you're way ahead of the game. Your voice is cut off. Your volume's off.
When you had mentioned you started with Hickson, was Eric Paulson in the room with you as well at that time?
You know, I was a good friend with Eric, and we used to connect a lot. I think I could have been Eric there. I can't tell you for sure. Could have been him there. But there's a lot of guys. Paul Lunak was there. That guy, Tom Cruise, who was his right-hand guy, was there. There's a lot of guys there at that exact same time. But yeah, I think maybe I did meet him there because I ended up having a good relationship with Eric. And then I know John brought him to the table during the fight times. But I can't say for sure if that's where I met him. I don't remember. You know, if you know for sure if I met him or not from Extreme or from Hickson's, I would know. I don't remember,
you know, I hold him in the highest regard. And still, he's still, you know, leg locking madness, which is pretty. But you said something that I'm taking notes. And I just want to back up Mike for a second and Joey. I never threw anyone in my life. I never tackled anyone in my life. That was not my game. Yes, he could do that shit, but I would never try to do things that with people that they could do better than me. And that's just not my game. So my game in jiu-jitsu, which wasn't jiu-jitsu, was more grappling than anything. And I would like to revisit this whole Machado thing
let me just ask you a real quick question. He had mentioned that with the Gracies, they were a little bit more hands-off with the people that were ambitious.
They're talented. You know, the thing is that they were intimidated by others. Their language skill sets were mediocre. And although Portuguese is an amazingly beautiful, romantic language, they were very intimidated. And, you know, you got to remember, and to me, you know, the Brazilian jiu-jitsu is the go behind choke and the straight arm bar, period. That's what it is. And all that movement between, as John said, and extreme fighting proved that you could get knocked the fuck out trying to get the go behind choke and the straight arm bar.
John Lewis, you also went to grammar school with Timo Leopoldo.
Yeah, and my man, I sixth grade. We met by him picking on me in sixth grade, and we got in a fight. It's a big fight. I'll leave it. I won't say who won, but we'll leave it at that. And and we became best friends. Literally, my best friend. Not just a guy that I knew, but we were best friends for a long many years after that. And he wasn't, by the way, he wasn't giant Timo. He's a little, you know, Hawaiian guy with glasses, you know, and I was a little skinnier guy than that, you know, like little skinny guy. But yeah, that's what we met. We met fighting, became good friends after that. You know, sometimes every time I fought anybody, they became my friend afterwards. Just, you know, that's just fighting is next best thing to having sex. It's like you get so intimate with someone, you know what I mean? In some way that you just feel like a bond with them. I feel like that's at least me. After a fight, you feel like you kind of gave everything and they gave everything. And it's like, put it behind us, now we're homies, you know? So like, yeah, a lot of times in my life that happened, but Timo and I were best friends from a fight.
When Timo fought Royce Gracie, Chris Brennan was on and he said a guy named Randy Ziegler was getting paid to go take privates with Hickson, learn everything he could, come back and show it to Timo. And that's how Timo was able to stay away from submissions for so long. Do you remember any of that?
I'll tell you why I don't, because after I left Hawaii, I didn't ever talk to Timo again. And I first saw Timo again, not sure if it was Timo, coming out with a cross on his back. And I was like, he was obviously so much bigger. And I was like, Timo? Is that Timo? So that's when I realized that was Timo. So I didn't even see Timo in all of those years until that UFC.
And then wild. Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah, I wish I had an answer for that, but yeah.
BJ Penn, you had some dealings with BJ Penn as well.
Yeah, he used to train at my school with me and my buddy Steve Sova for many years after health. He was there for a lot of years. And also eventually Charuto Verissimo ended up coming from Brazil to stay with me in my place and teach at my school as one of my students. And then eventually when BJ went back to Hawaii, still all pre-black belt, he took Charuto with him, and Charuto became his like private personal teacher out there, you know. Yeah, but yeah, he trained with me for many years. Yeah,
and I got pretty
cornered for fights, training for fights, cornered for him for fights and everything.
Yeah, so John Peretti, the United States at this time, I'm only speaking for probably 99% of the country, they were enamored with Brazilian jiu-jitsu. They this was it. This was like the do all and be all in regards to submissions and in finishing fights. If you look at your extreme fighting cards, it seemed like that you wanted to make a point that you weren't as impressed with it as everybody else. Am I off on that statement?
No, you're usually off. But what?
Thanks.
What? I have an incredible eye for weakness. I'm not the first person to, these are quotes coming back from me, but if you have an eye for talent, you have an eye for weakness. And I have an eye for weakness. And I saw early on that, well, we haven't talked about what John alluded to. So I feel like we're jumping, but I'm here to answer questions and to be his bodyguard for once instead of the other way around. I saw a weakness right away. You know, that's why I brought wrestlers in to work with kickboxers to defend the tackle. I mean, John remembers all this shit.
And also, you didn't bring in bad jujitsu guys to show that they weren't good. You brought good jujitsu guys in to and put them against other good guys, and so let happens what happens. You know, you sent an you asked me earlier and about my history, and I went into my backyard, but and my where I was kind of ahead of the game, and I think part of it was I had just studied a lot of things at that time. I already had black belts in a stand up art called Shokundo. I was doing judo. I was, you know, I had so many different attributes, and I was fast. I was athletic, as John said. So even though Carlson, at the time, everybody thought Carlson was going to beat me. Every school loves Carlson. He was great until after. And then all of a sudden, it was like, oh, he's overrated, they said. But Carlson's actually was great. If you think about it, we'll get into other fights later on. But Joe Hill, who had a very high reputation, Carlson was, I did less to Carlson than I did to Joe Hill. I mean, Carlson was a tough kid. But it just, you know, he didn't look the part, but he was a tough kid. But long story short is that I was able to be luxurious at that time enough to be able to take people out of their element, like kind of what John's saying, and weaknesses. Even though I was good in grappling, so was Carlson. So why? So I chose to not. And at that time, that was kind of, that is what mixed martial arts was. It wasn't called mixed martial arts until John coined it, but it was, that's what it was. It was me. I took whatever art it was the guy did, and I just did the opposite thing because I had choices at that time when a lot of people didn't have choices in those years. They had one art they were good at.
John Peretti, when did you really know that John Lewis was fight ready? September 8th, 1995, United Full Contact Federation at the Neil Blaisdell Arena in Honolulu. You hooked that fight up. How does that come together?
Nah, I don't think I hooked that fight up.
John Lewis just said it earlier.
I don't think he said that. I think you're paraphrasing. John?
Yeah. What I remember is you saying there's a fight in Hawaii, which, by the way, is where I was born and raised, home for me. Why don't you get out of your backyard and stop fighting all these guys that are just whoever's and fight someone else like you? You want to do it? And I said, just do it. I didn't even ask how much. It didn't matter. The money was so small, no one cared. So I don't know how John got to that place of knowing about it, but that is how I was told to.
That's
why I said I wouldn't have done it without you, John, because I wouldn't have had that opportunity or even known about it if that set me on my trajectory of fighting, you know.
So that's who was the promoter?
It was Matt Heumann, those guys.
Oh yeah. So I might have been, you know, partially responsible for that. But he was ready before that. And that's why I said, get out of your garage. That sounds like me.
Yeah. Being up a lot of, you know, other martial artists, karate guys. I was looking at it like I was just trying to fight. Like anybody would come to my house, they wanted to fight with me. I wanted to fight with them. And I especially wanted different martial arts, not because I was trying to be tough, because I really was trying to create something that could, my own version, my own art. Probably after like Andre, to like John said, from Bruce Lee's inspiration, I wanted to do that too. I wanted to find out, well, how do I fight against a karate guy? How do I find it? So what I was able to do was learn what they do and how to fight against it. So I was really good at like being able, knowing the different martial arts, knowing just enough of them that besides the ones that I took on 100% to be able to fight against them. And that's what I was trying to achieve. I was trying to understand all the arts. I took Aikido, Steven Seagal's school, by the way. I did all those things, but not to become a black belt on those things, to know what they were going to try to do to me so I would be able to deal with it. And that was how I used to think at that time.
Ooh, I think
John, I was so happy when I met John, someone so skilled, they could fast track me so quick. It was, especially in stand-up and tie boxing and kickboxing, it was really a big honor for me.
And, you know, John Lewis, I think that one of your lucky points of meeting John Peretti is, like you said, he can see, you know, he can see like positive attributes and he can see like things that are holes in people's games. The guy was a decade ahead of anybody else matchmaking. It could get you beat no matter how good you were. But where I think that we're missing here is your dojo is at your house. And you've got pretty much an open challenge for 6'6" and over 250 pounds. We get like jujitsu instructors. They're coming on here going, man, every once in a while, a guy walks through that door, got to choke him out. And if I don't, it's my reputation. Your address must have been very popular amongst the tough guy community.
Yeah, I had flyers. These really cool little flyers all over the
did you really?
All the martial arts stores. And it wasn't like I was getting people that wanted to like beat me up. The people that just, they would test me out, but it's really, I'll train you for free if, because I wanted to be, because I would spar everybody personally. So I wanted to go against them. And what, and I would be willing to, if they were going to be an advantage for me to work with because they're so big, I could learn from that situation, then I would train them for free and replace. And I, a lot of my students were big guys, SWAT team guys, six big tall dudes and big heavy guys. And they weren't the hardest guys, believe it or not. And I learned how to fight against all different types of people during those years for that reason.
So, Jeff Brady.
I just got tears in my eyes from that one. Go ahead.
So Jeff Brady, Thomas Puckett is the opponent for John Lewis. He's a Carl Gotch top student. Was there concerns on your end in regards to Mr. Lewis's first fight?
No. And that Carl Gotch word gets thrown around a lot, man. A lot. Gene used to fucking talk to me all the time and said, you know, you're the only guy out there like Olympic lifts and does this and does that and swims underwater and does this and that, just like Gotch. I was like, wait a second. You know, that, by the way, the reason that I got to meet Gene LaBelle is because I spoke to Carl Gotch for 4 hours on the phone and he gave me LaBelle's number.
Really?
I'm the man.
Yes, sir. But anyway, so that Carl Gotch thing gets thrown around, you know, and in fact, there was some guy from Florida, some fighter, I can't remember his big ass white guy's name. And there was just a lot of guys thrown around that name. But I knew that that fight would go a certain way. And I don't always know that a fight's going to go a certain way. You know, you alluded to that before, but that is not the truth. But I knew that this was just the beginning. This was a fucking, he's a juggernaut. I mean, he really is, you know. I'm not saying that, but I think y'all sitting down, I don't want you to fall and get hurt, right? So what I think is, in all my experientials, he's the most heroic fighter that I experienced.
Well, here, and let me double down on this for you. You got one fight in Hawaii. Obviously, your striking seems to come from a Wing Chun background. Your second fight is against one of the Gracies. You got Carlson Jr. And
my fighting didn't come from a Wing Chun background.
Your stand up?
No. Yeah, like a high boxing style.
Okay,
but so, I did.
He taught John was teaching me Wing Chun, but I was more talking before that.
It seemed like some of your movements came from a Wing Chun style in your first fight.
Bruce Lee.
Yeah, in your first fight.
But it wasn't I wasn't even thinking of it that way in the fight. I was just
moving.
An arrogant, dumb kid that just didn't see a possibility of losing. You know? I didn't even see the guys fight any of his fights before. I knew he fought in Pancras a lot, never saw a tape, never cared. It had no question in my mind that I would win, but almost I was overly arrogant as well because I hadn't been in that scenario against a pro fighter of that level. I've been amateur fights and that kind of stuff, you know. But like this, and just lots. I mean, come on, I grew up in Hawaii. I fight every Wednesday. Every Wednesday we'd have a bridge. We all met underneath the bridge and we'd fight and we'd say, "Okay, you go against you." Every Wednesday was like what we did to my entire life. So I fought hundreds of fights, you know. But. So to me, it's just another guy. I don't know the difference of the professional and not professional. I just fight, you know? So, but he was definitely skilled. But in my mind, you can tell by watching that fight, I never fought like that again. As far as that nonchalantness, that was just an arrogant dumb kid that was just happened to have a good night that night.
But I saw his fights.
You saw his fights. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
You were comfortable. What John Peretti then opens up, or actually starts an organization called Extreme Fighting One. November 18th, 1995 was the first fight. So you've got, technically speaking, one documented fight underneath your belt. And Peretti throws the last name Gracie at you as an opponent. Any concerns?
I have a problem with your lingo right there.
Can I go first there?
John Lewis. Well, go ahead, John Lewis. Any concerns when you hear that last name?
No, I mean, well, I had respect for the Gracies like everybody else.
Of course.
I was with Hickson, who no doubt is a badass. you know, and I had the mystique too, that I thought the Gracies were, you know, unbeatable and everything. I believed all that just like everybody else, but I also knew I was really talented. And I also knew that I had way more attributes than jiu-jitsu. So I actually felt very confident. In my personal opinion, and I've seen other people do this, and I won't even say names. If anybody who just chooses jiu-jitsu fighter after jiu-jitsu fighter in those days, we're just taking the easy way on purpose, because it's when people start getting good, it's so easy to not, if you know anything about jiu-jitsu up to a purple belt level, and you can do other things in those days, you could just consistently just be safe and win by striking, you know? So that was almost the easiest path, was to fight jiu-jitsu guys. Yeah. But not now, because now the world's evolved, right? Everybody can do everything.
Yeah.
But I mean, the days of guys were just jiu-jitsu fighters. And if you had boxing, Thai boxing, jiu-jitsu, judo, you had the advantage if you knew enough jiu-jitsu to not, once again, like every art I studied, enough to not get caught on the things that are the mistakes, then I knew they would be in trouble. So I wasn't afraid. I thought I would win, although Hickson and everybody else thought I would lose for sure, and didn't kick me out of the school. I actually asked permission from Hickson if I could do it, and he said yes, until I started excelling, and then they kicked me out.
John Peretti, you said you had some issues with my vernacular.
Well, threw him. I didn't throw him at him.
You remember? I mean, John, it's just words, man. I'm just trying to question out.
I just want to make sure that people understand.
Well, wait a minute, John. That's a huge thing. Like, in terms of opportunities, people fight their entire careers and never get a chance to fight a Gracie, and that is their dream fight. This guy's second fight, and you give it to him. And
I would look at it this way, though. It wasn't just that I was being given a Gracie. I was being given a title fight in my second fight. That was a gift.
Yeah, I was waiting for somebody to say it.
It was like, John, give me a chance to be the champion of Extreme Fight. You know what I mean? So that was actually a gift, because it could have been given to anybody with a lot more experience than I had.
So what happens here is osmotic, right? So it comes from an area of greater concentration to an area of lesser concentration. It goes downhill. Shit goes downhill. So I create a sport. I look around me at the people that I respect who could maneuver and become the pinions of the sport. And our relationship caused that to occur.
Yeah, give an opportunity, because you got to know the right people in life. I knew the right person, and it's fair enough to say, nothing's wrong with that. And I was given an opportunity, and I ran with it.
Yeah. I mean, to kind of add to that, I'm not going to say you knew the right person. The right person respected you.
Offered me that if he didn't want me to have a chance to be his champion. And he gave me a chance. He gave me a gift. He gave me a chance.
In 1995, I mean, it was Gracie mania amongst there was a lot of sicko fans just going, oh my God, the Gracies. Oh, they're never going to lose. The greatest fighting team in the world, Carlson Gracie's fighting team, the Sun 600-0 is fighting John Lewis. Dude, people, I remember talking about this pay-per-view with people just like selling it. Like, I can't believe this is going to take place. And people would be laughing and laughing. And did you have an idea that there was going to be the heads of that family pointing fingers at you because of out of anger and spite, because of how well you performed, that they would kind of dump on you? Did you expect that to happen?
Like I say, at first they all were like laughing. Sure, go ahead. Like, they thought for sure I would get beat. So no one cared. And by the way, you know, the families are so at each other, you know. So
it's true.
Hickson's family and Carlson's family, first of all, weren't in love anyways. But jiu-jitsu above all for them. So even though they didn't, like, if I was going to fight someone from Hickson's family, that would have been a different conversation, right? Because it would have been more than just the fact that it was jiu-jitsu. It was also been family. In this situation, if I win against one of Carlson's, Carlson's son, who Carlson I love a lot, father, son's beautiful as well. He's beautiful. Junior's beautiful as well. Then who cares? It's not that family. But if there would be, once there became a risk, they started seeing that I actually could do well and saw my competence, that's when it started, a problem started. Because I literally, if they would have said to me, no, I don't want you to do it, John, I was enamored, I hate to admit it, but I was enamored enough by the whole Gracie thing that I probably would have passed, you know, just because I would have been like, well, you know, it's my teacher saying I shouldn't. And I was a dumb kid, like I said. But they said, yeah, go for it, with a laugh on their face. And I was like, let's do it. I can do it, John. Let's do it. You know? And then that's where we went from there, you know. From there, I got thrown out. Talking about the families again, from then I got thrown out. And then I reached out to Carlos Machado. And they took me in. Because once again, even they wouldn't help me, but they didn't care if I beat the Gracie, right? Because that's the Machados. They have their own problems at the time with the Gracies, right? So but even then, eventually, I think the fact that I was going to do that well in jiu-jitsu got me kicked out of that as well. The better I did, I got kicked out. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. Carlson Gracie, all of us can say it's a man we admire. It's a man that needs to be respected. The only Gracie that didn't break bad on you was the guy whose son you fought.
Carlson was always giving me good advice, always, you know, he was always like super sweet to me. Even when I was going to fight his kid, he was sweet to me. After, he was sweet to me. Yeah. You know, he was a really, really kind person. Yeah.
You know, there's Gracie's we don't like. Well, what about the father of the kid that I fought? No. John's a good dude.
Carlson's a different guy. He's not political that way. It is not like the, you know, none of that stuff. You know, he was very different.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. You know, when all that stuff was going on, you kind of know who your friends are. And that's what I like to tell people. Whenever you're going through a bad moment or on the receiving end of garbage, you know who your friends are. Like, you know exactly, like, who's got your back. And Barrett Yoshida definitely falls into that category with you.
Yeah, he's fam.
You know,
Egan and Ensign, their black belts, and he's Egan's student. And when I was training, and not only training Egan them out in Hawaii, but also they were helping me prepare for fights. That was the whole circle I was in. So they know very well my abilities and how good I was, because I was training at Unlimited out there with them when I'm preparing for my fights. So Barrett knew me from way before, you know, how good I was, you know.
That's awesome. John Peretti, Hoist Gracie, gave an interview in Black Belt Magazine.
Who did?
Hoist Gracie, trashing extreme fighting, being a knockoff organization, not being real jiu-jitsu. I mean, he concentrated on a Mario Sperry fight, him not really being a black belt at the time. What was your fallout like around this time?
What was my what?
Fallout with the Gracie family, because you were also kind of
out there. I had no affinity with them. How could I have a falling out with them?
Well, they certainly pointed fingers at you publicly.
Everybody pointed fingers at me, you know, but they had, you know, they were running an infomercial, you know? So when I watched that first fucking fight, I don't know where you were, John, but I had to watch. I watched that fight with like LaBelle or Keating and Dr. John Keating. I don't know where the fuck I was, but I watched that fight. I was depressed. Because we had gone out, we lost our backing, and we didn't get to come on like we were supposed to. So we had to start all over again. Donald Zuckerman, man, what a fucking savior. I mean, just a genius and a savior. The film commissioner of Colorado for the last 30 years or some shit. Yeah, so we had to start all over again. Were you there? Did you watch the fucking Ultimate with me?
No, I was with the Gracie crew. Because Hoist had trained at Hickson School the entire time. So I would see him every day training for that fight with Hickson, rolling together. And I was in awe of, oh my God, yeah. So I was in that hole.
So I was not in awe.
I was, because I was in that world at that time, you know.
Hey, John Peretti, I'd even say you kind of stuck your nose up at him.
That's not my personality. John can attest to that. I'm not an in your face kind of guy. But
you weren't impressed. It was as plain as day.
It was not straightforward. It's critical.
A work is a work. You know, if you want to call what I coined purposeful mismatches a work, you can. you look at it any way you want. You know, my cousin in his pajamas is going to beat up a bodybuilder. What a great show. I mean, no, but you have to understand how hard I had worked at that point in time to have a sport, right? And this isn't an interview about me, so fuck off.
It's okay. Well, here, all right, I'll take that. So, John Lewis, so check this out. This guy's got two fights. His third fight's in Canada, the extreme fighting where fighters were getting arrested at the airport, lots of pressure from the local police departments on the Indian reservation. Did you even think you were going to fight that night, April 26, 1996?
I mean, I thought it was. It was a different time, you know? Like, I mean, we would learn the day before about constant, I mean, every changes. Like, we learn. I train for a fight for 30 minutes straight, and then I find out that it's going to be, you know, 3 15-minute rounds or whatever it was, or whatever, 2 15-minute rounds the night before, because that was had to be that, or else we couldn't do it. So and I'd be all like, not only me, we'd all be like, wait a minute, you know, we train a certain way, and because, like, you know, you're training it became 5 5-minute rounds, and you train a certain way for this long fight, and thinking you're gonna, you know, cook the guy, let him get a little tired, and you're gonna kind of, and the next thing you know, you're getting a perfect 5 minutes. That's a totally different training scenario, you know. So I would have those kind of changes the night before. You don't have to take your time for 5 minutes, because then you're back on your feet. You gotta take them down again. So those kind of things happen constantly, you know. The gloves, you know, when John came up with the gloves, they would the night before, it's like, you guys have to wear these gloves tomorrow. And I'm like, what gloves? You know, you notice the first time with Gracie, there was no gloves, right?
Right.
So that's how I train.
Wait. Yeah. Excuse me, John. Yeah. A couple of years ago, Hickson said he invented the gloves.
It's not possible.
I will say, to Hickson's credit, he's got some mental issues right now. I mean, that could be a byproduct of it. And like, I'm not trying to be like a smart ass. I'm really not trying to be a jerk, but he does have some issues right now.
These are easy things to qualify, because there was a show one day that had no gloves, and then there's a show the next day with gloves. And who was fighting before and after? It's very easy to figure those things out. Right? That, like, right? I fought the fight before with gloves, and then the next fight I fought without gloves, the next day I fought with gloves. So something right there changed. You know, we didn't do it for fun. We didn't do it for fun. We did it because we had to do it, you know.
The world changed. Martial arts changed forever. Because if you had looked at martial arts prior to that date, it was Japanese guys in World War II cutting off POWs' heads for Bushido, cutting off Chinese people's heads for practice for the Aikido. When we started this sport, the world changed. Martial arts changed forever. And because of people like, I don't know where a point. He's. I don't know where he is.
You're going to go. Yeah, there we go. That way. There we go. Yeah.
Because of people like him, that's why martial arts changed. And he is a representative of the most incredible change in the history of martial arts since the fucking Japanese talked about what they talked about.
Joey, I think the one thing that, like, and I mean, this is like our 220th episode. The reoccurring theme that we have is that back in the old days, the John Lewis, the John Peretti days, you didn't need a lot of fights to have a reputation, because the guys on the high end were all studs, like all of them. Like, you could have a 500 record and you go, that's one of the toughest guys in the world. And the record is an indicative of who you are as a fighter and your toughness. Joey, would you agree with that?
Well, there were so many fake records back then. How many 400-0 guys did we see on those pay-per-views? And how many 400-0 guys have ever existed in the world? Zero.
Travis Fulton.
Yeah, right.
Right. Some of those Monty Cox guys are Jeremy Horn.
They go to Iowa.
He's not undefeated. He's got a lot of fights. He's not undefeated. A lot of fights.
Yeah. No, but, you know, during that time, like,
Gumby. What? I called him Gumby.
Oh, he's great. I loved him. I met him first. He came to one of my seminars. And I taught him how to do a butterfly sweep. Anyways, in those days, there wasn't a lot of opportunities to fight. So you wouldn't have a big record in actual professional fighting. So, but a lot of us fought a lot in other ways in our other worlds, and we would say, you know, we had this many fights. I didn't, if I said how many fights I've actually had in my life, it would be ridiculous like that as well. But it's because, but who are you fighting? Right. So, but there was nothing else to compare it to anyways. There was nothing else to say I should have been fighting them instead, unless I was going to fight pro kickboxing, you know, or pro boxing, right? Which I wasn't that. So I guess people tried to quantify their fights into their as their records, plus made a lot of numbers up as well, obviously, in those days.
But I got to come back to the heroics of this man, because it was his hungry attitude. It was his willingness to go up against things. So different, not the hunger, but so different than my own. Because one time, I think, we were giving a seminar. I don't know where the fuck we were, but we were giving a seminar, and there was this Division I wrestler who hadn't wrestled in a while, and he wasn't impressed with what we were teaching. And so John Lewis decides he's going to roll with him. And this guy is really strong, and he's really skilled, and blah, 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 blah. And John went head-to-head with him, and head-to-head, and they fucking worked. And then John submitted him. But I was watching, it was just like, and I'm shaking my head going, what the fuck is he doing that for? Why is he doing that? I said that a lot during his career. What the fuck is he doing that for? He didn't have to do that. So then I
it's
rolled. Do you remember this?
Yeah,
it's a
seminar.
Then I rolled with him. Then I rolled with him. He tackles me to the ground. I get him in my guard. I fucking put him in a triangle. I'm going to choke him out like that. So it was like a 20-second fight, right? So that's John Lewis. That's John Lewis, who's willing to go.
I made my flyers. I updated my flyers with a picture of me, that guy in a crucifix. An actual fight, someone had a picture, and I ended up using that as my poster for one of my
so
but that's John Lewis, you know, willing to go and do jujitsu against Kenny Mundy, right? Who every cowardly fucking Brazilian would not take that fight. Know who what he could do and what he couldn't do because I rolled with him, right? So I know how strong, I know this, I know that, right? And still willing to get a straight arm bar on a guy with biceps attached at his wrist.
Well, here, let's talk about John Lewis' street cred, the arrest in Canada after Extreme Fighting 2. Walk us through that process.
I didn't get arrested.
Me or him? Oh, you. Him?
You didn't get arrested? John Lewis?
I didn't personally get arrested. Some guys did. There's so much of us. Everybody was kind of scattering like cockroaches. I heard some rumor that some people swam across something, like help or somebody swam. So I don't know what's true or not true, but some guys
health hid in his room and ordered pizzas in. He hid in his room.
Yeah. So I know everybody was, you know, kind of just trying to get out and to not getting caught. And by the way, we still knew we had to fight the next day. That's the one that we ended up going to the Indian reservation, right?
Yes.
So we still fought. That was our night at 3 a.m. I do remember this. I remember sleeping on the bus at 3:15, whatever time it was, at 3:30 a.m, going to our next place we were going to hide and sleep at because the fight was that next day. Like those were our circumstances, you know?
We have no idea.
We were there to fight, though.
Here's a misconception. The misconception is, sorry, John Peretti, I apologize. So the misconception is that you guys got arrested after the event. You guys got arrested. Well, I mean, some people got turned away at the airport.
All right, John. I do know this. Wait, before John can jump in. I do know that we got to go, guys. The police are coming. Blah, blah, blah. Get your stuff. We got to move to another hotel. Like mid 3:30 something in the morning. I don't know if people got arrested then or after the show, John. You got to tell that because I wasn't involved in that part.
Well, Tommy Sowards did an incredible. You remember Tommy?
Yeah, of course.
Tommy Sowards did this incredible German documentary on Extreme Fighting 2. And he released about, I don't know, Mike, how long is that little clip he released?
About 20 minutes.
So now this is like a 3-hour documentary, which is going to be released very soon. But it was incredibly tumultuous times and real nail biting shit. And a lot of it had to do with the ultimate calling the dogs on us, and we had guys arrested and stuff like that. So we had the fight, we had the show finally, we put together people and finally got the show going. I left to be with my pregnant wife who was pregnant with Luca Labelle Peretti. And then when I heard somebody got arrested, or eight guys got arrested, I flew back to Montreal and turned myself in to get arrested so I could be with them. But it was fucking heavy, man.
Yeah, I don't think I got arrested. I know. I think Igor did, right? I mean, Igor.
Yes.
I don't know where the hell I would have been, but I wasn't in the back of a police car, so I don't know.
I'll tell you what it is, John Lewis. You're a street guy. You kind of see things before everybody else does.
Yeah,
you saw what was going on. You did this, and you're booked.
Little mustache on. Yeah,
right. Who, me?
Yeah. I probably lived on the street. and the usual suspects on him.
You know, John Lewis, I think one of the things that kind of get forgotten or put by the wayside is that you were Chuck Liddell and Tito Ortiz's trainer at one point. And when they fought each other, where were you? How was that dealing with that?
That was a tough one. I trained a lot of guys at the same time because I had the premier school. So, I mean, my school had, I can name 15 big names that you know all in the same school at the same time in my school. It was very common. And those two were my fam from the beginning. It was very hard because I didn't want that to happen along the whole time. And they were good friends. They were very good friends at one time. And then somewhere along the way, I knew it had to happen. It was like this fight, him against him. And I had to make a decision where I was going to be. And by the way, I'm super close with Tito today. And I'm super close with Chuck today. But at the time, my honest opinion was Chuck was always super like loyal and in the way of like giving respect to where it's due. Everything of that nature, you know, super hard. And Tito was kind of had the little group around him. And he kind of was doing his own thing and he was younger and he was, you know, and I just felt that, I just chose to go in corner, Chuck's corner, but nothing was harder for me than looking over that railing at Tito. Oh. On the other side. It was really hard for me because I really did care about Tito a lot. We had a lot of fun together out of the limelight. And we're very close today. Still very close.
So did you know that Tito Ortiz invented the mixed martial arts club?
Tito's also taking a lot of punches. John,
all I say is everything's easy to figure out by the timeline by just watching the fights. You can see when there was a glove one day and when there wasn't a glove another day.
Tito wasn't even fighting when I invented that glove with Dr. Aslanik.
I'm just coming up with excuses for people, John Lewis.
Yeah,
that's where I'm at. You know what I mean?
I've been concussed more than Tito. That's not an excuse.
So when Tito was running around with Eddie Ruiz, Tank Abbott, and those guys, did you kind of stay away from that stuff, John Lewis, or did you?
That was just before me, I think, because my team was Luis Pedernera's Valley Tudo team, and that's when I started having all those guys, you know, were training with me during that kind of little crew of ours, and that was after that, yeah. And during that whole first time, I mean, a guy named Nick Blumgren brought him to me. He's a close friend of mine. One Kick Nick in Vegas. Great, great coach, great fighter. I knew him since I was 17. Him getting me into nightclubs. And that's another fun story. But he brought me to that one fight. I heard you guys mention it one time with Chuck fighting at the kickboxing fight in the New Orleans arena or whatever, when he kicked the guy in the head and knocked him out. That was my first experience. I was brought to the fight to see him as a prospect for me, when I trained him to fight and teach him jiu-jitsu, teach him ground fighting. He was a wrestler, obviously, but he was really a kickboxer. Obviously he had a great pedigree in wrestling, but he saw himself as, you see, he always wanted to knock you out with a punch and kick. That was his thing. So they knew he needed to get some ground skills to compete in that. I went to the fight, saw him, thought he was great, being buddies. And from then on, he started training with me. And we went through a whole schedule of time when he was being offered hardly any money whatsoever to fight. And I say hardly any, I mean, $1,500, hardly any money, you know? And there's a year he didn't fight, and that was me telling him, don't fight, just wait. And it was really hard to hear for him because he wanted to fight, but I said, you got to just say no. And then sure enough, a year later came around, they made a lot bigger offer, and his career trajectory went up. And I cornered him for every fight from the beginning, there's one tribe before me, but from then on until just before Keith Jardine that I was shooting a movie. And from then on, I didn't coach him, but that whole 12 year span, I was in his corner every time, train him every time.
Did you ever, I think he also fought in a Cobra fighting, Mark Hall's event, the Cobra Fighting Federation. Did you ever go to those as well?
I had some of my students fighting. Tony D'Souza, that's why I broke Tony D'Souza there. I broke a lot of guys there at that. I had a lot of purple belt level guys that I would put in those fights. They would win in 20 seconds each, every one of them. But that was, so I used to go there every now and then for that reason, just to break the door guys. Yeah, that was a crazy outside little event, but.
Yes, it was.
My guys just dominate those things. So that was fun.
What about Kaja's Cage Combat? Did you ever have your guys participate in those?
No, I don't think so. No.
Okay.
I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't think so.
Okay. He's one of the guys that argues that he invented the octagon. And I think there's some credibility.
Maybe he did. I don't know, dude.
I'm telling you, I think there might be credibility there. So yeah. Anyway, in regards to
what was in UFC 1? What they use?
They used an octagon, but he was doing it like 6 or 7 years before. And okay. he even had it in a movie 2 years prior.
Possibly then, yeah. I don't think they're using an octagon in Brazil back then. So no. Maybe he did, yeah.
No. I mean, either way. When you talk about the lower weight classes, if you look at like the 155, 160 pound division around that time, the clear number one in the world, like inarguable, Rumina Sato. Man. He was the guy, in my opinion, became the first number one human being at that weight class.
Yeah.
He's on your friggin' record, bro.
He was like my idol at the time. Yeah.
You know, and like it's a draw on your record because there's no judges. But if you look at it, it's as plain as day who won that fight.
I think all my draws are that.
Yeah.
Well, I take responsibility for that shit.
I can't think of one draw that I was losing. And I don't remember hardly breaking sweats in those fights. I just didn't. I could have pushed harder, but I definitely dominated all of them. Yeah.
Bro, that fight, it made me a fan. Like right then and there, I knew who John Lewis was. Like I was always like, man, he's got the look. He's got this. He's got that. Oh, dude, it's Rumina. It's Rumina. And then when I saw that, I was like, holy shit. That first performance is masterful. Absolutely.
Those were 8-minute rounds, correct? 3 8-minute rounds?
Yeah. That's long.
That's crazy.
Yeah. That was great. That fight was really great. And like I say, before that fight, I was a huge Rumina fan. I am still now. Me and him are, I mean, we're not, I wouldn't say we're friends. We always like each other's posts and say nice comments. Yeah. He never, I see him posting fights about the people he beat. He never posts my fights ever. I don't like him. I don't know. I think he's just respectful where we really respect each other. And I have no interest in that either, you know, but that fight, John gets a lot of credit for that fight too, because there's that one moment in there. You see me when I really hit him really hard, which was broke the orbital bone. And that was that was John Freddy. Cause I was in the corner at him. I was posted up there comfortable.
And, no, you were in the center. You were in the center. And I said, John, bring him over here.
Oh yeah. And I walked him over. You see me, they walk him over and they say, look, and she said this, look over to me. Okay. Now act like you're looking to me and then punch me in the face. And I literally went, boom. You can see the video. No,
what I said is, if you'll recall, what I said is, John, he's listening to my voice. He doesn't understand English. So the next time I speak and I'm going to pause, right? And then when I open my mouth next time, his head's going to turn to look at me to see what the fuck I'm saying. And you're going to knock him out.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, with an exception of, this is the perfect example of what I was trying to say. In Japan, the headlines, they called me Mr. Cool. And the reason was, is because I always seemed so relaxed during the fight. And by the way, I usually could probably talk on the phone during a fight or during jiu-jitsu matches, you know, because I'm that calm in my mind. When I'm, you know, I don't mean literally, but you know, I'm that calm on my mind. I have done it before to pick on people in my school. I'm having to take a call when I'm beating somebody up. But the point is that for me able to be to listen clearly to John under those circumstances with someone that good, I really was totally fine. You know what I mean? I never felt like I was in jeopardy, not because of him. He's amazing. You have to be on your game, but I was really good at being on my game. I was really good at feeling the beginning of someone's movement that was going to be a problem. And dealing with it at that moment. And all my fights were like that. I always felt like I was, I think it's a problem for me. I think my problem was that, I don't know how to say this without sounding arrogant. I thought I was too good. Not that I was, I thought I was. And two, I just felt so in control that I didn't go, I was under enough pressure besides Kenny Monday. I was under enough pressure that it forced me to fight for my life back. And I think all those draws are my fault. You know, although I feel I dominated them all, I literally didn't, I don't even remember being tired after fighting.
If you, I can interrupt here. If you get a draw in Japan and you're American, you won the fight. But I mean, it's just, it is what it is.
And but Rumina, like one mistake with Rumina, one little mistake, you're done. You know what I mean? And I knew that, and I respected him so much then, and I respect him so much now.
You look at the pancreas guy's records too, and that's one of the things that we highlight. You'll see a pancreas guy with just an under 500 record, and he's got wins over Anderson Silva, or he's got wins over just monster fighters. It's just that's how life is.
On one of my cards, on one of those Vale Tudo cards, that's to tell you how long Anderson's been fighting. When I think it could have been the first one when I fought, and Frank fought Anderson, might have been that one, could have been the next, but Anderson Silva was on that card fighting, and that all that career he was fighting until even recently. I mean, what a long career that is, you know.
And you look at like Rumina Sato, we discussed his background. Chohil de Oliveira, beat Pele Landy up a weight class on short notice, throwing 100, almost like 98 headbutts in over the course of a fight. Pele Landy, just so everybody at home can understand the context behind this, beat Pat Miletich when Pat Miletich was a world champion for the UFC outside of the organization.
And so Matthews.
Matthews, you sure about that?
Hang on.
Yes, I'm sure.
Hang on.
Okay.
Hang on.
Go ahead, Peretti.
I was the referee.
You think that's a... You referee in which fight?
Pele Miletich.
For the WEF, Jamie Levine's fight. Yes, you were. And Miletich was, I know he was kind of under the weather, but he needed the cash.
He was so injured. Oh my God. John Keating shot up his fucking back with, I don't know what the fuck he hits up things with, but he used to shoot my hands up before fights. He was so injured. He was in fucking like psycho spasms. But yes, I was the referee.
Mr. Question, John, do you remember? I'm not even going to go any further on it. Rumina Sato fight 2. Do you remember my circumstances going into that fight?
Just help me.
I had a flu. I was in a hospital. I was in a hospital up until a week before the fight. And I went down to 147 pounds, which is 20 pounds lighter than normal. Would you tell how skinny I was in that fight? And I tried to pull out of the fight. But they said they were going to pay me win, lose, or draw. They weren't at the time. But then they said they'll pay the same money, win, lose, or draw. So in my arrogance, I thought that I would just hold on and not win. I just thought I would not get beat, and I would just get my money. And I remember after the first round was over, when I was sitting in my corner, I was seeing those little silver dots everywhere. I was so dot. Yeah, I was getting IV. I was throwing up in IVs. I was so sick. I was so dehydrated, and I was tripping, and I dismembered him across the ring, just like chilling like this. And I remember sitting there going, what the fuck was I thinking? Like, I literally was thinking to myself, what the fuck? And I was thinking to myself, if I go further than this, it's inevitable. Like, I'm not going to come back and beat him. I just couldn't even hardly stand up. Not to mention, you know, so I just, at that point, my mind was just gone, man. I was like, what did I do? And I kind of just took my medicine and it happened what happened. But that was definitely a different scenario. And I was literally hospitalized for a week before. And I just tried to, like, because I was so stupid. I just thought I would just hold on and just get through it. But he was ready to go after a year of him not fighting, and he wanted revenge. He was ready. Yeah, he was in good shape.
He wanted you too.
I'll never forget that window of being so tired in the corner, seeing stars and looking and seeing him just jumping. And I was like, what the, oh shit, what did I get myself into? You know? Well, you learn this. These are the things that I learned that I teach my students. Like, you know, like, I mean, I only said this now just to laugh at it. I'm never the person that says, well, the reason I always say, if you are so bad that you shouldn't be fighting and you choose to fight, then just shut up afterwards. Don't say your hand was broken. Don't say your leg was broken. Don't say you were sick, because no one cares. If you're that bad, then you shouldn't have fought. If you fought, just take it like a man, which is what I always tried to do and give him the credit that he deserved. But those are what I teach my students. You know,
but that's heroics.
Yeah,
you see, that's heroics. You gotta fucking understand this. You know, this isn't some fucking guy piddling around. This is heroics, and seeing that doesn't take a genius to see that in him.
Yeah, Kenny Monday, talking about heroics. Kenny Monday, I mean, obviously gold medal winner, beat Mark Schultz in wrestling.
Two golds and a silver.
Two golds, okay. Thank you. And he looked every bit of 200 pounds against you.
Just so you know, so I'll tell you, I'll expose myself all on this one too. First of all, people ask me, what's my favorite fight, my best fight that I ever had? I said Kenny Monday. And the reason is because that's when I really learned a lot about myself as a human. First of all, my natural weight was 160, my natural weight. And I fought at 155 and 175. But even when I fought at 175, I was still 160, 162. I was like, you know, and when I fought at 155, I didn't even try to cut. I just trained hard and I kind of got there. But with him is where I really I learned the difference between an Olympian and a great wrestler. Like, it wasn't that I couldn't catch him like I could catch any other wrestler. I caught him. I went from an armbar to a triangle to an armbar within 15 seconds, 20 seconds. You know, and I popped his arm, pop, 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 pop. But when I was sure, he's just going to tap. I'm going to armbar him and he's going to tap because I'm doing the proper jiu-jitsu armbar. He's going to tap. And that's when I realized you don't become an Olympian just giving up because you got sore. And from then on, I was like, oh, shit. but here's what I said. Here's why I say it's my favorite fight. I was getting hit in the face a lot of times from the bottom, trying to attack his leg. And in my mind, this is how messed up, stupid my mind was, and also how arrogant my mind was. I said, I'm just going to let him hit me in the face so he's busy while I try to attack his leg. And I was going like this, very aware of it, thinking that he's going to be busy doing that. Because I didn't know what else to do, to be honest with you. I couldn't get him off of me. And I didn't want to just hold him. So I was trying. I never thought I was going to lose until I lost. And I never thought I was going to, and I didn't get knocked out. I got referee stoppage.
Yeah.
So sometimes I didn't get knocked out and I didn't quit. They stopped it because they needed to stop it. Yeah. But in my mind, I thought I was going to find a way to win until I lost. And that's why I say it was my favorite fight, because you never really know what you're made of. It's easy to be cool and dominative when you're beating people up, but to be in that scenario, and that's where you really find out what you're about. You know, like, do you just give up? Do you just, and I always say to myself, I never thought I was going to lose until I lost. And that told me a lot about myself. You know?
So I remember being in the hospital room, holding your hand in there and just looking at you and going, feeling terrible about what you've been through. But then, you know, you had a moment of lucidity and you looked at me and you said, well, what do you think? You remember this?
No.
And I said, what the fuck were you thinking? What the fuck were you thinking? Because that's him. That's him going to go up against that in the way that he goes up against everything, because that's the heroics of it.
I'll tell you this too, that's the first time that I dabbled in steroids. And my natural weight was 155, and I got to 172, which was to me I'm bigger than that now, just try not to be. But at that time, I was bloated. I was, you know, it wasn't even in the proper weight, you know. So that makes you burn your muscles faster, your cardio faster. I made a lot of mistakes in that fight, just trying to be big enough, but not big enough for the right reasons, just size-wise big enough. So I definitely wanted to fight him. I was definitely not afraid to fight him. I knew how good he would be, but what I always tell my son and myself as well, like, anything that's going to be something that I would be scared of, I'm absolutely going to say yes to it, because I'm not going to be able to live with myself if I say I was afraid of that guy or afraid of the situation. So I said, how can I cannot say no, or else I'll always regret this, you know? So that fight was important for me for all of those reasons. I went after my fears. I never thought I was going to lose until I did. I never gave up. That I learned a lot about myself that day as a man.
So Mike there's something that you don't understand about Kenny Monday. He was the master of cutting weight.
Oh, yeah.
So he probably came into there at 190, walking around at 190 and cut weight. He was the renowned master of cutting weight. So when you say he looked like X, he was X.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't even, it looks like a giant. It looks like you're fighting a giant. Yeah.
Even with me blowing it up, it still looks like, you know, but those are like, those are excuses. It's not like I didn't know before I went in that he was going to be bigger than me. That wasn't okay. It didn't matter. If they said he was going to be 200 pounds when I fought him, I still would have said yes. Cause it wasn't about, I wasn't trying to be in my safe world. I was just fighting. Cause I wanted to remember my whole world started with me saying, come to my backyard so I can see how I am against you. That was my entire career. By the way, I'm gonna expose something. I hope you don't mind me saying this, John. But when I fought Carlson Gracie, the purse was $4,000 to win and $0 to lose. That was my purse.
I don't remember.
Yeah. So me and both Carlson both got $2,000 each. So it was never about money. It was always about trusting myself as a martial artist. Every fight in Hawaii, I made $500.
Yeah. You know? Wait. Was that one of those Gracie rules that they put in, like 4,000 or nothing?
There was no money in the sport. They couldn't pay you that much money. The shows weren't making money. Like it was like, do you want to fight or do you not want to fight? You know, we got to build something together. So for me, I never even asked for the purse. I never negotiated a purse. You know, I'm sure I was always taking care of the best I could be taken care of. And in Japan, I think I was me and Frank Shamrock were the most highest paid guys in the business almost at that time. Because I was always, if you look at the rankings in those days, which I never can find anymore, I was always ranked number one, two, or three in, for the whole my whole career in that division, you know. But so I made $20,000, you know. $20,000 was like, and I was like, oh my God, $20,000. I spent that money buying a big screen TV on the flight back before I even got home. So I lost you. Oh yeah, anyways. Let me go back to you. I lost you something.
You're good.
Yeah. So, I mean, like it was never about the money, you know, it was never about the money, which is a whole thing to keep in mind those days. Two things, gripes I have. Records. I told you honest the other day, because records don't even matter from that time.
Wow.
You can just expunge them because there was no judges. I didn't get a draw because the judges saw it as a draw. You had to either knock them out, finish them, or throw in a towel, or it's a draw, no matter how good you do. So my record shows three draws, but there are three wins in my opinion, if I was had a judge. But my
record,
so everybody from that time, those records mean nothing. They shouldn't even be used.
If you don't have a draw on your record from that time period, you probably weren't a good fighter because you got to finish.
If you're fighting really good guys at that time, it's really hard to finish them. You know what I mean? So I'm fighting good guys consistently. Yes, John.
Yeah.
So I want to clarify something. We're talking about the sport that I created. We're talking about draws because if you didn't knock him out and he didn't submit, right, it's a draw, right? So from a matchmaker's idea, and from a guy who understood what can happen in boxing, which is that judges can be bought all the time, I was offended by the word judges. So I did not think, because if a fight was great and it was a draw, what would I do, John? Well, we match it again, right? You get these great guys, we're going to do it again because it's great. If it was a terrible fight, John, we shelve it and we pull up the guy that we think won that fight and we keep building the what? The pyramid. It had to make sense, unlike the ultimate, which didn't make any fucking sense. You know, my grandmother and her, a car can fight this guy who can fight that guy. It just didn't make any sense.
Well, I think that also caught on in Japan as well, that way of thinking. Because they stayed with that system much longer than the American counterparts.
You know, call me right now.
EJ. EJ Penn.
EJ Penn. I'm gonna have to call him back.
Put him on the show. So you're gonna tell him next week. Good. Okay. Good. Yeah. We'll handle him next week. ADCC 1998, obviously Abu Dhabi Combat Club is the largest, most prestigious grappling event in the world currently. You were at the opener.
I'm listening to you. Until I'm calling back. Call you right back. Right back. Sorry. Okay, go ahead.
Abu Dhabi, 1998. You were at the opening of that prestigious, you know, right, organizations. How were the hotel, you know, what was the hotel like? Who was your roommate?
I had my own room. So once again, these are the things that like change so much. Like, first of all, I was deep in my fighting career, which is all I cared about, right? And that was what I was doing. Then I got offered a chance when I never even left hardly anywhere besides California and Hawaii to go to, you know, Middle East from a sheikh, you know, from Tak Noon. And I thought it was going to be this amazing trip. To me, it was like a vacation, and I get to go on it. And all I got to do is wrestle. I had no expectation of what the ADCC was. I didn't even give it the same respect that it was. I mean, it was just grappling, it's wrestling. To me, I'm a fighter. I make money fighting, fighting, you know, right? Oh, man, I'm making money fighting. And like, this is like the best fighters in the world get to go. So it's prestigious. It said I am one of the best fighters in the world at a very short time in my professional career, which is kind of cool. And I just got to go to the Middle East. So I didn't even practice, train, nothing. I just went, you know, and it was first class, everything, beautiful rooms, beautiful. You know, they took us out on boats and all kinds of, and treated us really, really great. It was a great, great experience for me, which is why I kept going back. But in my mind, it was just like a free vacation. That's the energy that I gave it at the time. Looking back on it, people did very, very well who were smarter than me. And like people like Kenzo, who's a wonderful person, who really put a lot of time into the people out there, you know, that because he was a lot wiser than I was.
Yeah. John Pretty, you're the matchmaker. Lowell Anderson. Lowell Anderson is a Gracie student. Was this a call out by them in order to try to get John Lewis beat?
I don't know what people are thinking, you know, so I can't comment on that. I have no idea.
Did they ask for the fight?
No, nobody asked me for fights.
Okay.
And I never saw it as that either. I saw it as your next opponent. And
really? I mean, if you look at it on paper. Huh? I'm reading into it, you know? John Pretty, what was your thoughts about making that fight?
I don't recall.
Okay. John Lewis, any pressure going into that, being that you're going to be cornered by former people that you trained with? Like,
being totally honest earlier, anytime you're given a straight Gracie or straight, I can't say Gracie, a straight Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu fighter at that time, to me, it was an easy fight in my mind. Yeah. Just because, what, he's going to Jiu-Jitsu me? At that point, I'm really good at Jiu-Jitsu at that stage. And I could definitely box, and I could definitely kick. I mean, I was way further than I was in the very beginning when I fought Carlson, and Carlson was Carlson. So in my mind, I was like, that was like, oh, great. I knew I would do very well in that fight, just put it that way. Because I knew that he couldn't take me down. And if he did take me down, he couldn't beat me, probably couldn't beat me on the ground. And I just figured, why go to the ground? It gives him one chance at least, right? And I knew all my hands were going to be better. So I felt very, very safe in that fight, honestly.
It ended up being a hell of a showcase for you. Footwork, your stand-up.
PKO, yeah, it was good for me. It was a good one for me.
Skipper Kelp, you can tell he had some ingredients in on that, on your side.
My boxing coach and close friend, he definitely got my boxing cleaned up. And my straight boxing, he's such a great boxer.
Yeah. I mean, it's like you've had a hell of a career, man.
But look at the wealth of information. Yeah. Look at the conglomeration of who he is.
We've both been around for a while. It means we're old.
I'm old.
We've been around for a while. We've been around for a while.
And you got to remember, this is just the surface level of what's there. I mean, there's so much more depth. You know, and we're just kind of skimming off the top here. I mean, it's here, Laverne Clark, monster, absolute savage. I think under the right tutelage, the guy could have been a world champion, probably one of the hardest punchers in the world at that weight class at the point. Jens Pulver, like you fought the best of the best, man.
you. Yeah. Yeah. They were good guys, man. They were really good. Yeah. And I have to say, I always like to have good matches, and those were good matches.
Beverly Hills Jiu-Jitsu. We're going to start wrapping this up. Beverly Hills Jiu-Jitsu. You guys had some all-stars there. Can you open up a little bit about Mark Lehman?
Yeah. You ask and I'll answer, but I'll answer honestly anything you ask.
I know there was a little bit of a falling out, but let's just talk about him as a instructor and a competitor, or somebody to go against in the gym.
Okay. He's great jiu-jitsu guy. He came to me as a purple belt. I got it. He got a brown black belt from me. He was trained over at Beverly Hills Jiu-Jitsu with a couple other really great guys, Juno Mark, another guy named, who, if you remember him from the old days, he was great as well. But yeah, he came over and trained with me there. He lived in my house, lived on my couch, you know, took good care of him. At that time in my life, I was high in the nightlife industry as well. I spent a big part of my business in Las Vegas was nightlife. And I made a lot of money doing that, way more than doing martial arts. And so I would, I'd have him teach my classes because I knew that he was so good and respected that they'd be fine that I was gone. So when I would be busy all the time, I'd have Mark Lehman always teaching the classes for me and everything was great because I knew that people would be happy. Then what happened is, this is many years, by the way, over many years of me being very taken good care of him, you know, as a friend and as a mentor and him and my student. When I went out of town for a fight, I don't remember which one it was, he went through my Rolodex and took all the numbers and called all my students and told them that they left with him, he would train them free in their garage. And I had all champion jiu-jitsu guys at the time. I had the number one school in jiu-jitsu. If you notice all the competitions in those days, there's always Luis Pedernera's always winning. You know, there's one funny thing we had. It says Luis Pedernera's wins all matches, seven submissions, seven titles. They even won the mountain bike gravel. And he went through my Rolodex and called everybody and a lot of my great guys who've been with me for a long time, purple brown, and including like people like Roy Nelson and Big Country, all of them, they all were with me, you know, and he was with me until brown belt, Roy Nelson was, then they all went with him. And I understand because he was there as their teacher and they built a camaraderie. I thought I was safe because I was putting someone in a position that I could trust to make sure my guys were okay. But he took advantage of that. So that's why we went to that stage of me being that upset with him. There's never been anybody else that I've been that upset with, but I was really betrayed because I lived on my couch. And then, you know, and I had to start over. Both. I built my school again after that. But the people that I lost were people that were with me from white belt to brown and purple, you know, good guys. You know.
Yeah, he's in Milwaukee now. Yeah, he's interesting guy.
I don't care anymore, but yeah, I was really upset.
Okay, here we go. Next one. Mark Kerr at Bas Rutten. Mark Kerr at this time when he was training with you was also battling addiction. He was documented in the Smashing Machine. Did you kind of understand the depths of the issues he was dealing with at that time?
Let me clarify. He was never a student of mine. He was a good friend of mine that trained with me, literally with me, like we rolled with together.
Okay.
So I don't get credit for his skill level. But I definitely showed him some stuff and he showed me some great takedown stuff and we would wrestle each other, which is pretty cool because I was 155 pounds and he was the UFC champion at the time. So we had really good matches. I knew that like those kind of drugs were going around at that time. You know, I had friends that passed away from him, but I didn't realize the severity of the depth of it at the time, to be honest, no. Because he was just such a good guy. He's a great guy. He's such a good, positive, loving individual, and he's DJ again. I'm gonna have to
go ahead, dude. It's BJ. We got appearance for BJ Penn, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm literally on an interview, and they're hearing me talk to you right now. So let me call you right back. I'm gonna call you right back, and as soon as I'm finished, okay, brother. All right, love you, buddy. Call you soon. Okay. All right, man.
That counts as BJ Penn. We had BJ
we finally Penn. Got him on the show.
We got him.
Yeah,
we
finally got him. That's awesome.
I didn't hear him.
Yeah, I could have had that set up. That's my son.
Could have been talking to anybody.
That's my son calling from another room. So I didn't teach him, but I trained with him, and I was a good friend of his, and he was great, but I didn't realize the extent of it. No.
Okay, Joe Moriera. What were your thoughts of him?
He was an interesting guy. He was a Brazilian guy that, but he had a lot of tournaments, and he was smart enough to understand that this is where he lives now. So he was cool with the other Americans. I'm sure he had his loyalty to Brazil, you know, like I would imagine. But he always treated me really well, really respectful when our tournaments, when we competed at all of his tournaments, and he was really good to the team. So I have nothing bad to say about Joe Moreira. He's a good dude.
Yeah. I mean, even
nice guy.
The Luta Libre guys, black belts in jiu-jitsu and dealt with the ramifications.
He was a businessman. He did right. You know, he did right.
We're going to close it with this. You cornered Gilbert Ivel in the UFC. What was it like having him in your gym?
That's my brother. He moved from Amsterdam to Vegas to train with me and lived with me for a while as well. And he was there for about 3 or 4 years. My son was born. He'd carry my son around and try to pick up girls, holding my son like it's a little dog. Like that's how when we go to the pool together, he'd be carrying my little newborn around and get the girls. And they talk to him for the baby.
Some people still do that.
Yeah. It works, right? Women, your dog's so cute. Yeah. No, he's an amazing guy. He's such a great energy. He's such a funny guy. Always playing, always making jokes. Another great kickboxer.
How was he as a training partner, though? Because I've heard stories where he just sometimes he's like Hector Lombard. He can't dial it down in the gym.
No. he's family to everybody in our gym. Would play with, have fun with everybody. You know, he's very kind. He can be hard or soft. You know, he's a good guy. I never had problems with Gilbert. He's a really wonderful person. And I talked to him the other day. Yeah. He got his black belt recently, Rimpo Pardo.
Really?
He started jiu-jitsu a long time ago before me with Rimko. Yeah.
There's always kind of like an edge to him. Like it's always kind of, I'm not going to say a chip on his shoulder, but just like leaning into conflict. And in our interview.
You know what he reminds me of? Is Quentin Jackson. Like, if you know Quentin Jackson is a good dude and he's funny and he's nice and he's friends with his friends, but he has this little side of him. If you don't know him well, you're like, I don't know, because he could be scary. Gilbert's the same way. If you know Gilbert, he was like a baby. You know, he's a big baby. He's funny. He's sensitive. You know, he's a good guy. And now if you don't know him, you just see this other thing, but that's not how he is. He's a good, good dude.
I'm
not even trying to cover for him. He's like literally like a teddy bear.
Yeah, he was a preteen in Haiti, moved to Amsterdam. Mom saves up her money, is like cleaning like hotels, goes home and visits. Civil War breaks out. He doesn't see his mom for about another decade.
Yeah.
That's Gilbert Ivel.
Before he came to Vegas, they brought me out to Amsterdam teaching seminars. And I was teaching Alex Overeem and all those guys. In my seminars, and they were way smaller. he was still big. They put a lot of weight on afterwards. But all those guys were training all.
Before he started eating horse meat.
Yeah, he's a tough dude. After that, he's a tough dude. But yeah, but they're all just students of mine. They were not. I was just students of mine. Guys that I trained. But Gilbert, he just fell in love and bonded, and then he just like, I'm going to come to Vegas, and he did. He packed up and moved to Vegas. Yeah.
Let's have the closing words, man. Anybody, any final statements? This is probably your last MMA interview ever for the rest of your life.
Maybe not. It was a pretty nice interview. I actually enjoyed it. Everything was great. I'm just honored to be on the show. And thank you, John, for asking me to come on. And just for me to have another chance to be in the same room with John is really an honor for me because it's been many, many years.
Good shit, man. John Lewis, you're an absolute legend. Honestly, man, we've been chasing you for 2 years. Peretti, this wouldn't have happened without you, sir. I appreciate you, John.
I bet you say that to all you guys.
No. John Lewis, all right, brother. Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Bye, John. Thank you.
John Peretti.
You got it done.
You motherfucker. Dude, John, let me tell you something, John Peretti. You started dangling like these little things to Joey and I, and we'd be like, oh, okay. And then, you know, I'd be cool, calm, and collective. And then Joey and I would be like little schoolgirls, like fawning all over. Like, do you think Peretti can do it? Dude, this was less than 10 days.
Be careful what you wish for.
Thank you, bro. John Parady, I'm serious. Like, here, we started the interview like with John Lewis going, yeah, nobody really gives a shit anymore. You know, it's just people don't care. You know what's unfortunate? The people that like get the likes and the views on YouTube, they are so unable to understand what took place there that the perception is, yeah, they don't give a fuck because they don't know. They're stupid. The only reason we started this podcast was because guys like you weren't having our stories properly told. You guys weren't getting your just due. And that right there, phenomenal.
Yeah, I think you should do another one with us.
I think that extreme fighting, yeah, I agree. Like, I've got more questions. I know he...
There's just so much. There's so much in terms of... Not that... You know, he didn't just zoom off into the world because he's a juggernaut in that way. But we didn't touch on so much, especially that the triumvirate of Lewis Parady Zinoviev.
You know what? We did not bring up Zinoviev. And I'll tell you what. You have thrown Zinoviev's name around with us. If we get Zinoviev, I will not only lose my mind, but what we could also do is what we sometimes do is we have like the guys that really formed a bond together. We have them all on and we just shoot the shit. I throw out a subject, back off. You guys discuss it amongst yourselves. Wherever the direction the conversation goes, it goes. It's not like this is a formal interview. And what that is a discussion and a conversation. And those are just as important.
So you told me to go fuck myself?
that didn't sound like that.
Just the opposite. So John Parady. There's a lot there. There's a lot of layers on that onion and involving yourself and your involvement in mixed martial arts and your reclusive nature over the last decade, it kind of highlights
two decades.
Yeah. I called John up the other day and I'm just like, you know, John, I'm kind of, you know, balls deep in an eager Zinoviev right now, figuratively speaking, eager Zinoviev,
eager
Zinoviev. And I'm just like, there's a lot more here. Just reading a record and watching the fights and kind of understanding that's public, you know, that the public can even wrap their heads around. But once it's verbalized, they can kind of catch up and see it. And, you know, you're the, you know, the guy leading the orchestra at this period of the sport.
Well, it's the definition of a has-been, you know, I mean, it really is. It's the perfect thing, you know, as Joey said, Joey talks too much, by the way, the fossil, you know, I mean, it really is, you know, I'm somebody that's, you know, been conveniently blackballed and whitewashed. And, you know, everybody wants to take credit for things that that they had nothing to do with. And it's unfortunate, but I as Joey said, the first time we spoke, I would like, you know, to have people understand, it'll probably never happen, but I would have liked to have people understand that there are reasons for me not being in, say, the Hall of Fame or being acknowledged in any way, shape or form, the disappearance of me. Yes, it's part of my cloistered, you know, clandestine kind of way. I don't like the limelight, but you know, someone should give credit where credit's due, and that's what you guys are doing so wonderfully.
The truth needs to be told, and not power washed, not sugar coated. It needs to be told as is. We're not whitewashing history. This is history from the people that created it.
And I think John was very eloquent about that.
I agree. John, why do you refuse to use the term takedown? You like to use tackle rather than takedown?
Is that LaBellian?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the guy, I can't even explain it.
Listen to this. I asked the question. It's because Joey and I have been wrapping our heads around your last interview, asking 50 million different questions to each other about you. But go ahead. Gene LaBelle, please.
Oh, I can't. I mean, it's just, it's so enormous. You know, he's ironically my black belt. So he's, and I his, but Gene LaBelle was just larger than life. You know, he was a gargoyle. And you know, I can still smell him. You know, I mean, he would take our gis, and at the end we're soaked in sweat 8 hours, which is my methodology too, to teach. You know, I'm going to be teaching at the Gus George on the 18th, and it'll go from 8 a.m. till, you know, maybe 8 p.m. It's just the way I still do that. And I always have done that, even before I met him. So we would be soaked, and then, you know, he'd take our geese and put them over our face and pour water on them. You had to take it.
He waterboarded you?
Clearly. Okay. He would choke you out, right? Wake you up, tell you he choked you out again. Yeah.
When he choked me out, when I woke up, he was kneeling above me and saying, "Don't worry, I'm okay." Well, that was my experience with him.
That's pretty classic. He got so tired of choking people out at seminars, he'd say, "Go ahead, John, take over." And then I choke people out and give them a patch.
So in Chicago, we also had a guy that did things like that. And his name was John Wayne Gacy. That's who it was.
Well, the thing that I really honored most about Gene, and you would appreciate this maybe, Mike, but he never drank alcohol or took any drugs ever. And that's why he couldn't train at Bruce Lee's place, because they're all smoking hash and, you know, and getting fucking high. And so he could not go over there because of that.
Wow. I respect that. I got sober at the age of 18. I haven't had a sip of alcohol since then. Never in a pot, coke, none of that stuff. Yeah. That's good stuff.
Well, I drank for you.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. Yeah. John, the era, I think another big issue, historically speaking, that kind of plagues you and the guys of your era, is that it's the dark ages. It's the UFC dark ages. It was like the hardest events to watch because John McCain was pulling shit off cable and
human cockfighting is directly at me.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, you guys are interviewing. I haven't listened to those interviews for a good reason, but you know, you interview Meyerowitz, you interviewed David Isaacs, you know, you've done these interviews. And to me, those people had no idea what I was about.
I will say this. I will say this. Like, you have to remember, like, we're fact-finding. And a lot of the information that we uncover is previously not only not documented, but it's unknown. So right now, like, I've got several questions that I wish I would have asked Meyerowitz and David Isaacs that I think the interviews that we've done are absolutely phenomenal with them, but it would have been kind of like that shock and awe component that we get in some of our interviews. Like, I didn't have that in my artillery at that point, but we do now. And, yeah, it's wild, listen, man. It's fucking wild. Listen,
Joey, listen to this. I will debate anyone on your show. Anyone. I will debate them. And I will demolish them if they lie.
So, Give us
Tito Ortiz.
First of all, Tito Ortiz's head is this fucking big, right? And I have this little pinhead, you know, it's like, it's just, but yeah, something's wrong with Tito recently that he thinks that before he became a fighter, he invented something that he never had his hands in. And John looks at it, you know, chronologically, and I look at it in terms of some, you know, bus came along and hit him. Now, I've taken more abuse than Tito Ortiz has. I mean, you got to understand that. And John alludes to it, you know, that I came from New York and I fought anybody, everybody. I went to every school I could possibly fight in fighting.
Here,
and,
okay, here, let's throw a name out there. Jason DeLucia. Did you guys ever meet up?
I met him, but that's a Jeet Kune Do guy's a Boon Action, you know, all that stuff, you know, I pulled away from that stuff. You know, Gene saved my fucking life. John Lewis just texted me, fun, love you.
Good. Yeah, so Jason DeLucia was actually like, there's actually old message boards that still
exist. No. I mean, I met him in Japan, obviously, you know, I mean, he was in the clique, but I thought he was a handsome kid. He wasn't as talented as you know, many of the other guys. But, you know, I was ringside for Pancras watching him fight and stuff. Sure.
Okay, so Jason DeLucia, there's still old traditional martial arts message boards that are still up and running. And he has a long history as a teenager of going to dojos and demanding fights with people. But mm-hmm. he also moved to California to fight
Steven. I lost my dog. I am listening to you. I'm listening.
He also moved to California to fight Steven Seagal, like Zane Frazier. And like there was probably two or three dozen people after the Steven Seagal Playboy article, the $50,000 challenge or fight to death.
God. I mean, did you hear what Gene did to him?
Oh. Yes. Yeah, I heard about. Yeah.
I mean, I talked to the dresser on that show, you know, I talked to wardrobe.
Wait. Let's go. For audience that doesn't know, what happened between Gene and Seagal?
Fucking, you know, arrogant. Listen, when I met Steven Seagal, he was as bald as me and you. And then he started getting hair implants, dyeing his fucking head. When he did that movie, and he comes out of the water in some Martin Sheen apocalypsian thing, they had to close the set because the dye would be running down his face. But anyway, his ego is bigger than his belly now. And he was bald. I mean, he's a monster. He said to Gene on set that no one could choke him out. I mean, that was the premise. So he's talking to Gene LaBelle and he's saying that no one can choke him out. And then, you know, they had to change his wardrobe because he defecated himself. That, you know, when you hang somebody, right, and people don't show this, but when someone is hung by the neck, because I have to talk about this stuff all the time when I'm teaching, you lose your bladder control and you lose whatever else is inside you. It all comes out. And that's just the way it is. But, you know, his fucking ego, his stupidity, you know, that he could defend the choke from a man, you know, with size, you know, hands that this big, I'm not fucking around. I can still feel his hands on me. No idea about the density of information and what you had to assimilate.
Hey, let me just kind of get a feel for Gene as a human being. Steven Seagal says no one can choke me out. Okay, does Gene say
that he could defend it? That he could defend
Wait. So does Gene say, okay, count to 10, then we're gonna go, or does he just go right in for the choke and choke the shit out of him? Like, which guy is Gene LaBelle? What's his approach?
First of all, he's got that that vaudevillian thing so he can get real close to you. He's always touching people. So once he gets a fucking handle on you, which is a key word, and things I still teach, I teach an hour and a half of handles on human beings. He would touch you in such a way, like he always, like, if I was there, he would like put his hand on somebody and I'd go, oh no.
Okay. He's one of those old cats. Yeah. Okay.
Oh my God. I mean, he's in a world all his own. You know, I remember, I think it was Donald Zuckerman got a little nasty with him and I had to rescue Donald from his clutches. It just, he would snap. He took no shit from anybody. And he just loved me. I don't know why, but God damn, I miss him so much.
Yeah. 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 Bigger than life. You know, like when jiu-jitsu came and it was the best and you're whatever it is you're practicing is stupid. Every once in a while, like the jiu-jitsu community verbally would kind of bleed into the, oh, dumb judo Gene LaBelle. And the whoop, excuse me, like the overcorrection in regards to like stopping that statement from ever coming out of their mouths again. It's pretty badass, dude. It like, obviously I've never met Gene, but the people and reputations that came from that school and their love and affinity for him, it
and it, fear.
Well, that's
and
important.
Fear. Absolute fear, because he's one of those guys. I think it was the amnesiac McGuire said that the thing that really changed John Peretti was that he really became really sadistic after training with Gene.
Yes, that's good.
No, he's right. You know, he became a jiu-jitsu sycophant, but he's right, you know, because when I put my hands on you, you knew it.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, man, it's Joey, we just had John Lewis on and John Peretti.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we did.
We had John Lewis doing play-by-play, Peretti doing color. And Lewis's life, and you know, before this, John, dude, we had wrestling coaches of his children approach him for interviews. You guys have no idea, like the psychoticness that like Joey, I, and a few other people go through in
what
order
we've been through
to grab these interviews. Like it's like stalker ex-girlfriend. You know, type shit in order to get people on a show that never do interviews. And that's an impossible get. That right there, impossible get.
Well, the next one's even more impossible to get.
I can't fucking.
That's going to be great.
It. I will lose my fucking mind. John Peretti, I'm just going to apologize to the entire audience and you. I'm going to be the biggest fucking fanboy. I'm going to have to, like, you know, do like some mental exercises so I don't look like a total pussy.
You wait, you know, he's going to come on with the ability to recall clearly things and he's going to be understated. He is the definition of a man. I'm like a little, training with him, even when he didn't know what I knew, you know, I'm like a little femboy compared to him. He's a fucking man.
He's an Oviev.
Now, yeah. You two, okay, having read the book, you two got arrested.
The book?
Right here, Origin of the Species, available on Amazon for $20. You're going to have to scroll down a little bit because there's a lot of Darwin books they're going to try to sell you, but find it on Amazon. It's worth reading. There's your plug. And by the way, John, I didn't call you a fossil. You called you a fossil. I would have never done that.
And for
no
everybody
one has home, ever said I wasn't inarticulate.
Yeah, I will say for everybody at home that understands, I've purchased the book, but the hours I put into research for our weekly guests, it's astronomical. Joey was reading and giving me notes on the side so I could tell Peretti I was reading the book. And then Joey sent an errant text to Peretti instead of me, and Peretti sniffed it out immediately. Didn't even talk to Joey about it. Said, yeah, I know Joey's reading a book for you. I know what's going on over there.
Flip notes.
Can't pull shit by the law enforcement officer. I know.
God, damn. I fired Joey through text. I fired him.
And then no one else wanted my job, so I was immediately rehired. But I still talk too much.
You sold me out to Peretti.
He was threatening me.
Yeah. So I don't know how you could cliff note that fucking book, because it goes from here to there and back again. Oh, but believe me,
I heard.
What did he fucking say to you?
He was talking about getting bit by centipedes. You did surgery on a penis of your friend.
I didn't know him, but yes.
Oh, a stranger.
Okay. Oh, God.
No, absolutely a stranger. Yes.
You know what? I don't want to ruin the book for anybody, but there's a certain mafia figure that's in your life. I've got it all sectioned off. I'm going to do a shitload of research on that gentleman for your next appearance here. And I love that mafia MMA connection. You know, I really do.
Well, okay. The book's about a lot more than MMA. The book takes you down a lot of crazy adventures, and it's about a man who lived a very interesting life. I thought I lived an interesting life. Pick up the book, give it a read.
John Peretti, you're the man. Thank you. You're the fucking man, dude. Here's the issue with our fucking show. We're what, 2 hours and what in? Ladies and gentlemen, could you please like, share, and subscribe? Like, we're at the end of the show. Like, that's supposed to be like in the beginning.
What do you mean?
It's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, you're supposed to tell everybody in the beginning. Like, this is like the last few seconds of the program.
Well, I don't know anything about that. But neither do we.
Yeah, we're all on the same page.
What I will say is, look, aren't you going to do those little snippet things?
If I had a fucking producer we had this guy Tyson Green, dude, the best.
But Todd Atkins did all those little snippet things. And I was like, how do you do that? That's so interesting.
John, I got a wife. I'm trying to stay married. I'm trying to produce one interview a week. My preference, if I could do this, I'd try to do 6 a month. It's a lot of time. It's for your interview. I think we did like 16 hours of research. I've even like employed other human beings in order to help us, like C-Real from the Underground Forum. We've got other human beings helping us gather the research. So instead of like 16 hours, we can knock it down to 12. And it's a legitimate 12 hours. Like James Wormy's coming up. I got every bit of like 14, 15 hours in already. And
that's going to put holes in Meyerowitz's story.
Well, I'll tell you this. I mean, I'm hoping he doesn't get to this part by the time I interview him. He won't. I'll interview him before that.
Before
he will not see this by the time I interview him. I'm going to tell you this. If I lay it out the way I see it and kind of understand where the moving parts are coming in, lower his defense a little bit, get him comfortable, that might be the most like shoot interview that we've ever done with the person coming in, unbeknownst to them that they're about to shit on a whole bunch of different people.
Well, he's also, you got to understand something about him. He's hard to read because he's so political, kind of like he hates Trump.
He hates Trump. Like it's like too.
Well, I don't know what that means, but the point is he's so sober. Like he's very hard to get a read on because he's always trying to be like in the middle, kind of like.
Yeah, I'll piece it together. He's not going to be able to. I'll let him stay there for a minute. I've got several questions that he needs to answer. In particular about yourself. And
he's going to be really straightforward about me. I don't see him. he can remember shit that I can't remember. He's going to blow holes in the Meyerowitz stories. I just know it because he's just that kind of guy. I think he's like just a real straight arrow kind of guy. I respect him for that.
All right. Gentlemen, I got the old lady here. We got UFC 300 tonight, John Peretti. I look forward to our multiple texts a day between you, I, and Joey Venti. Honestly, dude, I really do. I really enjoy that, man. It kind of brings me back. And dude, if I had a wish list, and dude, you're batting 1,000 right now. If I had a wish list, I'm not going to say a name, but the guy that was supplying the cocaine to all the brass.
Why didn't you fucking ask him? You had your moment and you didn't fucking ask him. He would have told you. Today, he said I was on steroids and you didn't say a fucking word.
Well, here. Let me retract.
Point that finger at me.
No. 3 days ago, I get a phone call. I get text message. Hey, dude, you know, I really don't want to do this, but John Peretti asked me, so I have to. And I know you've asked me several times, and I don't want to do this. Could you give me a call? And it was just me as a therapist listening to somebody that was trying to figure out a way to get out of the room, you know? And I'm like, wait, well, dude, let's slow it down a little bit. Slow it down a little bit. I'll tell you what, like, if he's willing to go that route, I'm not going to ask somebody where they got their steroids from. Here, I'll give you a nugget. I used to send urine to a fight team because I've been sober since I was 18, so they could pass their piss test. My piss has been tested in New Jersey, flying colors, New York, flying colors, California, and Nevada. Who can say that? That's just put in the octagon. Who can say that shit?
That's just an excuse for having a really long penis.
All right, gentlemen, we got to go. Like, share, subscribe. If you're listening up until this point, you've never left an iTunes comment or a YouTube comment, you're a dick. There we go. That's our send off. Thank you, gentlemen. Take care.
Check out the full interview on iTunes, Spotify, and all major podcast platforms.